Welcome to the Gregarious Mammal Podcast. This is Chris. I am on the road using the internal microphone on my laptop just to bring a little introduction to this episode. So apologies for that. I am at a documentation hackathon in the southern city of Szeged in Hungary. Very interesting place. Probably cover some more of that when I get back. But I wanted to introduce two interviews again around kind of blockchain space. First is an interview with ex-Ripple CTO, Stefan Thomas. We will talk about Ripple and some of his new projects, which are Coil and Codeus. And that was an interview from Tech Open Air in Berlin back in June. And then the second short couple of clips is with Emmanuel Pouli, or Poulis, I think Pouli, from the Malta Blockchain Summit, which I will be going to later in the year, to talk a little bit about Malta, how it views blockchain, i.e. favorably, and more about the summit coming up in November. So enjoy.
Second product is XRapid. XRapid tackles sort of the next step up, which is a liquidity management. Mm-hmm. So today, the way liquidity is usually provisioned for cross-border payments is that people pre-fund money around the world. And so XRapid replaces that by using cryptocurrency to move money around the world. So rather than having money already at the destination, you have one pool of crypto, you move it to the country that you need it, you convert it, and then you can use it as liquidity for your payment. And it actually works with both XRP and Bitcoin, which a lot of people don't know. Mm-hmm. A lot of people think that because it's Ripple, it has to be XRP only. But in practice, like actually only our customers only use XRP because it's just cheaper and faster, and why wouldn't you? And so that's sort of XRapid. And then the last product is XVIA, which is essentially it's a easy API for anyone who wants to make payments to hook into the other two. Mm-hmm. So if you're a corporate or you're a payment service provider and you want to send money around the world, you can call this like XVIA API, and you don't have to worry how exactly it's going to execute and who's going to execute it. It just sort of provides this one unified interface. So those are the three main products
If memory serves me rightly, wasn't the protocols on PayPal that will begin with X as well? Is that a bit of a dig?
That's really interesting. Yeah, I always find the X thing a little bit silly because it comes, I think, from the X and XRP.
Yeah, I know.
Which is really just the ISO letter for it's not a country.
Okay, all right.
So it's not really specific to it, but that's what stuck. So.
Okay. So I actually did go to quite a good demo explanation from someone who works for you a year or so ago, and my memory was that it's more of a connecting point between the various protocols. That's the main thing that people are using. I'm guessing they're not. It's not Ripple itself. It's
Xcurrent.
Xcurrent. Yeah. I'm not sure if it was called that then, but maybe the portfolio has grown since then. And from memory, that was, you could connect, in theory, a US dollars PayPal account to a German euro bank account to a Chinese, maybe WePay account. I'm not sure if you've gotten into China yet, but in principle, that's that. Yeah. And how well is it working? I think you actually do have some reasonable clients now, or if you call them clients or just customers or developers, I'm not sure, but you have some reasonably well-known people using the protocol now.
Yeah, so I think at this point, XCurrent is well-established. Mm-hmm. It's been rolled out by some large banks. For instance, Santander is building an application called OneFX that lets their customers move money all over the world using XCurrent in the background. So that's actually moving billions of dollars already. XRapid is a little bit newer. A lot of the projects for XRapid are in production. They're moving real money, but they're still at a pilot kind of scale. But the initial results are really positive. People are seeing really real savings. And so we expect that will scale up. And some of the companies that have agreed to use XRapid are companies like American Express and Western Union. So they're big companies that are testing this.
And especially Western Union is interesting.
Yeah, exactly. Because it's actually interesting, Western Union, because I think a very interesting cost structure. They're not that different from like a TransferWise or a PayPal in terms of like the payment back end, how they actually fulfill the payments. But they have a very different front end where they have sort of the cash shops agents.
I actually interviewed someone in Dubai last year who was doing an equivalent for this, because he said a lot of the migrant workers there will literally get paid, they go to the ATM, take out all their cash, go to Western Union and transfer it back to their family. And he felt like it seemed like such a broken way of doing it. It was like one digital system taking out cash and then going to another digital system. Surely there was a better way. I don't know.
This is exactly what the sort of vision that Ripple has. It's like, how do you why is this so different for payments than it is for information? Mm-hmm. Where we now have the internet, and once you're on the internet, everything is sort of interoperable, right?
Yeah.
I can email you even if you're a different provider.
The money is still one of these things that people think of as tangible, even though actually for a long time it hasn't been, really. But people still think of it. And actually, in that way, you haven't mentioned the B word yet. You haven't mentioned blockchain.
Mm.
And unless I'm mistaken, I'm pretty sure that's what you are based on, some form or another, or not anymore, or have you invented your own kind of alternative to it? Or
yeah, so that I think that's a really good question. So Ripple's always been a payments company first, mm-hmm. and then blockchain has always been in our DNA, but we were never dogmatic about what technology to apply. And so what we ended up with is there's a little bit of blockchain in all of the different products. So for example, in Xcurrent, everyone in the transaction chain, we want to make sure that they see the same outcome of the transaction. So one thing that happens in Swift is that the message gets passed on and then something fails. And so some people have seen a successful payment and some people have seen a failed payment.
Which happens in the US and Europe quite a lot.
There you go. Yeah. And so with Xcurrent, we want to avoid that. And so we use a blockchain, which actually, you know, works very different than sort of the traditional shared ledger blockchain, because
traditional.
I've been in this space for 8 years, so this is like ancient history. So the traditional blockchain is kind of like you have a shared ledger, everyone's on the same ledger, and you kind of move that forward. But with Xcurrent, we essentially create a ephemeral ledger, a ledger that only lives for the duration of one transaction. And so that gives us a couple of benefits. So number one, you have better privacy.
Yeah.
On a shared ledger, everyone can see everything. On this kind of ephemeral ledger, we can create it only between the parties of that transaction, plus maybe the regulators that need to see it. So you can exactly control who sees what.
And you reduce the scaling issue, I guess.
You solve the scaling issue. Very astute. So, and those are exactly the kind of things. Like, when you apply a technology to a specific use case, you're going to make adaptations, right? And that's going to be the thing that makes it viable. Like, and so I think, all of our products use blockchain in some form, but it's adapted to that use case.
And I guess this might be why I for my own personal reasons, ignoring the technical ones, I was interested in what you did because of the kind of lifestyle I have led. But I know in the blockchain space, you're somewhat controversial. Mm. A, probably because you're using a sort of your own version of the concept, and B, because a lot of people say it's too centralized, which is a criticism of a lot of private blockchains, and that's a bigger discussion. Mm-hmm. But I guess what's your perspective on that? Is it kind of what you said, in that you were a payments company first, and that community can just deal with that? Or
well, I think to a large extent, what happened was Bitcoin came out first, and then Ripple came out to address some of the limitations of Bitcoin. Now, you have some community where people are very invested in it, and you know, like in some cases, they have a lot of money in it, and so now there comes this competitor. And so I think a lot of the criticisms were actually literally just motivated by, you know, hey, you're competing with us, we're going to make you sound not so good. Mm-hmm. And I think taking the centralization point, for example, like, you know, the XRP ledger was really designed to be more decentralized than Bitcoin. There was more of a road to get there. I think Bitcoin started more decentralized and is getting more and more centralized to the point where we now have, I think, four mining pools that have a majority, two of them owned by the same company, Bitmain. Mm-hmm. So like there isn't that much decentralization.
Yeah, no, for sure.
And they're all in China too. And yeah, so it's
The whole decentralized ledger technology starts to make things more interesting. But the traditional blockchains are still actually way more centralized.
Exactly. Yeah. And so with XRP Ledger, we try to address that, solve that problem. And the way that it tries to address it is by having the users choose who the validator should be.
Mm.
And so with XRP Ledger, you've seen the opposite trend, where it started with just Ripple has validators.
Mm.
And now there are hundreds of validators outside of Ripple. And some of them are building up a track record, and so people are going to start trusting them once they see that they're reliable. And so you're going to get to a point where, you know, XRP Ledger is running on a bunch of high quality validators in a bunch of different time zones that have nothing to do with each other, while Bitcoin is still running in a few time zones in China and with only a few pools. And so I think you'll see that reversal. But, you know, I don't like arguing that.
No.
I prefer just waiting until it happens and then confronting people with the reality.
And the ledger you refer to, is that a public ledger or is it a...
Yeah, so XRP Ledger is a public blockchain.
You say you have the blockchain-like technology that exists for the lifespan of the transaction, and then the result of that is recorded in the ledger.
So the way it works is what I was describing earlier with the sort of blockchain that exists for the lifetime of a transaction. That's Xcurrent, and that's used for fiat transactions.
Okay.
With XRapid, we actually use cryptocurrency or digital assets, right? And so that cryptocurrency lives on XRP Ledger. That's a public blockchain. So in different products, we're using blockchain in different ways, right? So in Xcurrent, we're using it in the way I described. In XRapid, we're using it in a maybe more traditional way, although there are a lot of improvements compared to something like Bitcoin.
Okay. For a company that's interested in adopting the various protocols you have, what's the... How technically does a developer implement this? I mean, obviously in a big bank it's going to be probably more complicated from their side than your side, but just take, for example, there's a developer in Bank of Couch that wants to implement Ripple into their workflow so customers can exchange various currencies in and out. What does that look like? How does it work? Mm-hmm. What's the step?
I mean, it's pretty much a very traditional sort of enterprise sales process. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the payment service provider or bank, they would reach out to Ripple. They would engage with our solution architects and so on, and would kind of integrate it. I think one thing that I expect to happen in the longer term is, you know, while I was at Ripple and I'm in the process of transitioning out right now.
Oh, yeah.
We can talk about that. But basically, we worked on an open protocol, which we envisioned would be more like a TCP/IP of money.
That's a nice catchphrase.
Yeah, you know, the funny thing is, like, people have been using that catchphrase, I think, for a lot of projects that don't look at all like TCP/IP, whereas IntelLedger, the protocol I'm mentioning, is actually very closely resembles that stack. Anyway, so that's a protocol that we envision would be something that is more like TCP/IP, and then Ripple would be more like the Cisco of that world, where it's essentially it's providing enterprise integrations, providing enterprise software solutions, but it doesn't own the internet, you know. So I think we're going that direction. I think right now we're just in an earlier stage, an early phase.
I think I actually forgot that IntelLedger was also part of Ripple as well.
I know there's a lot of pieces,
and we haven't really talked much about that actually, and that. From memory, is basically a protocol of connecting ledgers. And how many ledgers does it support? Does it change? Or is it only focusing predominantly on financial ledgers? Or?
Yeah, so we've been working on IntelLedger since 2015, and in that time it's evolved quite a bit. Until I think in December we settled on what we call IntelLedger version 4, which we feel like is pretty much the last one. And I know it's a
bold statement in the blockchain world.
The reason we feel it's the last one is because we've always gone by, we want to get to a point when it's as simple as possible, but no simpler kind of thing. And so now with Intelledger version 4, the only thing that it requires from the ledger is they can transfer money from one person to another. And that seems like just about as simple as you can get. And so with that, we were kind of at a point where, okay, now we want to look more towards what can we use this protocol for. Ripple uses it in their products. And I'm about to start a company called Coil, which is going to use it a different way.
Oh, that explains the email addresses. Okay.
So I think Intelledger is a broader thing. It's something that is going to span lots of different companies, lots of different industries, and it's going to be used in very different ways.
Is it like a plug-in architecture then? Do you have a core and then people could write? If they invent a new ledger tomorrow, they can invent that.
Exactly. So Intelledger, when you actually implement it, the main component in it is what's called a connector.
Yeah, okay. I think this is starting to sound familiar now, actually.
So the connector is essentially what on the internet would be a router. So it's something that takes packets of money and it forwards them. I think the way that I would envision it being used is that, you know, any pair of connectors, anyone who wants to use Intelledger, they can choose between themselves, like, what do they want to use to settle. And like I said, the only thing that's required of the settlement method is that I can transfer value, right? And so if I want to settle with you in bags of candy, I can settle with you in bags of candy. Yep. You know, as long as you accept that and I accept that, Intelledger is fine with that. So it's an incredibly flexible protocol. And with that flexibility also comes the challenge of, well, what do you use it for? So that's what the new company is about.
And is Intelledger what a lot of decentralized exchanges use?
So Intelledger, it's not an exchange.
But as a protocol to make the exchange happen.
Yeah, so the way I would describe it is, it's a abstraction layer for how money moves. So it kind of says, like, hey, if I want to build an application that moves money around, that application doesn't have to be hard-coded to PayPal's API or Bitcoin's API. It can be coded to Intelledger. And then how I want to solve the actual problem of moving the money or converting the money, exchanging the money, is totally up to the individual user. And so what that means is the connector, if it is going across currencies, it might use a centralized exchange to settle, or it might use a decentralized exchange to settle, or maybe it doesn't settle at all, and it just sort of draws down a big balance of a crypto that it has accumulated. I don't know, but it really, the Intelledger layer does not care about that. It's just an abstraction.
Do you want to tell me more about Coil? Double check.
I'm glad you picked up the hint.
Picked up the subtle hint.
I'm very, very excited, obviously, to be going back into entrepreneurship, starting my own company again. This company is very much a spin-off of Ripple. So it builds on a lot of the research that we've done there. But we've kind of hit a point where we've been researching Intelledger for a long time. We've been advocating for it for a long time. But so far, you know, people have always gotten very interested, but it really takes somebody to build a great product on top of it to really get a community like that going. And so we feel like we're excited to try that. And so what we want to do is we want to essentially build a product to solve how content and applications are monetized on the web. So I'll give you the quick explanation. So if you are a website today and you want to monetize, you'll probably use either ads, or maybe you'll have people subscribe, maybe you'll have people support you through Patreon or a service like that. And the issue with most of those is that they're not really great for small content creators and small websites. And so it's led to a lot of centralization. So I think at this point, Google and Facebook make up something like 50% of the global ad revenue just amongst themselves.
I'm surprised it's not more.
Exactly. And that percentage is growing as well. I think if you take just the US and you take out China, it's closer to like 80%. It's a big number. And so I think where something like web monetization could come in is it solves sort of an age-old problem with the web, which is we have this one-on-one interaction. I request your website, you send it to me, but there's no way for me to pay you for that website. And in the original web standards documents, there's actually an error code that's reserved for payment required. And it's the error code 402.
Yeah, 402,
You might have heard of 404.
401, 405, 404.
Exactly, 402 is payment required. And that kind of tells you that they were expecting that there would be some kind of payment method built in, but there wasn't any protocol. I think
the W3C is working on some kind of payment standard, but I guess it's a more conventional method, yeah.
So I'm glad you bring it up because we were very involved in that. So, not surprisingly, so my colleague, Adrian, who actually came over to Coil as well, he's been co-chairing the web payments effort. Okay. And so what's happening there is essentially building a better payments experience. So today, when you want to pay online, you have to select the right payment method and you have to enter all your details and then you can pay. And so the idea with web payments is to make the browser sort of the arbiter of payment methods. And so the merchant says, hey, I want to get paid with Visa. And then the browser says, hey, I have a Visa wallet that's registered. So that's actually now rolling out and it's really making it easier to pay online. But what I'm talking about with Coil is actually going beyond that. It's rather than replicating how payments work today and just making the user experience a little bit easier, this is actually introducing a new category of payments below 10 cents, below 5 cents. And once you get to that scale, you can't really have the user click a button anymore because that would cost more psychologically than the money that you're actually sending. And so it has to be fully automated. But if you fully automate it, the user doesn't want to risk overspending on things. And so what Coil is going to provide is effectively a flat rate for the holdings of that. So you're getting this flat rate that we will pay the websites that you're going to. And so you have no risk. You have zero risk from overpaying because you're paying a flat rate. But then hopefully those websites will provide maybe extra content. Maybe they'll show less ads. Or maybe you're just doing it because you want to support content creators. So that's kind of what we're going to explore. And obviously, it's one of those experimental startups. We'll see what happens.
So actually, this is interesting. I mean, in my mind, this sounds a little bit like Satoshi Pay and Brave. Sort of. Brave is a nice idea, but the browser is too niche, probably. And Satoshi Pay, well, they've had their own dramas. And I think it works in a different way. How does it compare to those two? And I guess how will you attempt to solve the problems they've had and not have the same problems?
Yeah, so I think there's been a lot of projects over the years. And, you know, even if you go beyond Brave and Satoshi Pay, I remember
Flatter.
There've been projects for a long time.
But I discovered the other day, Flatter is, and it actually also based in Berlin, is owned by the same company as Adblocker Pro. Which is bizarre. Which I discovered last week, which is quite strange.
I remember the acquisition. I was somewhat sad about that acquisition because I thought, Flutter was a pretty great company. Adblock Plus, I think, a lot of content creators have not so good things to say about them. We have to dive deeper into it. But my point is, a lot of these existing micropayment solutions are effectively singular platforms, right? So you have all the users on Flutter and then you have all the projects on Flutter. And I think with something like Brave, where there is sort of a token in the middle, it's still one platform that the token is hosted on. And so I think what all of these projects have lacked up to this point is something like IntelliJ or some open standard that they can be based on so that I can use whatever currency I want and the project can receive whatever currency that they want on whatever system that they want. And it still kind of works. And not everyone has to have a relationship with the same company, right? And so that's, I think, what's unique about this project is we want to make it a true web standard.
Yeah.
So that it's not tied to Coil.
And then it's easier to get Google and Chrome to get around if it's a standard and things like that, because they're going to be someone who's fairly resistant. Maybe, I'm not sure. It was interesting.
I mean, that's the thing. Like, we now have these 3 to 4 years that we've been working on the web payment stuff, and those specs are actually rolling out now. Yeah. Chrome 68 is going to be the first version that has payment handler spec that Adrian, my colleague, has co-authored, actually built in. And so we have experience with how do you get a web standard from the basic idea to the actual deployment. Now, I don't want to promise too much because web monetization is definitely much more out there than web payments. Web payments was a pretty obvious problem.
Payments are easy. Pay for things is hard.
Exactly. And so we'll see how it goes. But I think that the important thing is to have this kind of neutral approach. If you're too tied to one platform, you're going to have a hard time.
I mean, actually, just to dig even further, it's an idea that has appealed to me for a very long time of that I think is more of an impossibility, but still, of, you know, if it's that adage of like, music sharing went down when Apple introduced the iTunes Store and made it easier to pay. And if you could have a way that basically you could access whatever you wanted on the internet, just whatever, download movies, download music, read pages, and then your ISP kind of tracked what you did and distributed, and like a tax on top of your monthly charge. But I mean, that's probably never going to happen. But it's
well, I will definitely spend some of my time trying to make it happen.
Well, at least in a browser, and then if you go into other protocols, it gets a bit more. And also, just the international kind of negotiation would be.
Yeah. Well, I think that what we've sort of seen with previous efforts is, it's a really good idea to just make the technology, make it work, and just put it out there. And stuff like this, you know, anyone who's a content creator that wants to make some extra money and also get some extra, you know, views can adopt this technology, and people that want to experiment with this can use it. And so it doesn't take that much for some community to develop around it. And I think, again, previously there have been so many projects for micropayments that have had some success within some niche community. I think the only thing that's really been missing is this open protocol aspect so they can really scale
and
communities.
Even get to the extent where you could, like, not only trade fiat currencies and cryptocurrencies, but like World of Warcraft money, whatever that's called, I'm not sure, and all these sorts of other strange, like, proto cryptocurrencies.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Well, apart from the fact you started a new company, is there anything else in the next 6 months that you want people to know about, or?
So much. I mean,
it's probably the main one, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. I think we could spend a long time talking about stuff. So, 2 weeks ago now, we released a new open source project called Codeus.
Okay.
So this is essentially somewhere between a hosting platform and a smart contracts platform. So this has been a lot of fun. I mean, for us, this has been a way to put a real production use case on top of IntelliJ. And it was one that we'd done some work on way back in 2013, 2014. And so we pretty much had it ready to go. We're able to put it out pretty quickly. So that's something that's kind of ongoing. We've been playing around with that. There's now 185 hosts or something, people running these Codeus hosts.
Okay.
And so very interesting to see what people will do with that. So it's essentially like a hosting platform where you pay with IntelliJ. And so what that means is that I can upload to a lot of different hosts using a single API and just pay using the standard protocol. And as a host, I can receive any currency I want. I can, I don't have to worry about what currency you're using. I'm just offering this open API for hosting.
But a host for the smart contracts or a host for other things?
It's Docker containers, so it's basically like any software.
It's basically a decentralized AWS.
Yeah, that's a great way to describe it.
That's kind of interesting.
Yeah, so the reason we did it is because what we want to show is, you know, everyone's going out there and they're doing an ICO and they're putting out a token and they're creating a blockchain and everyone's kind of got this architecture. And what we're trying to say is, look, you can do it a different way. You can have no token, you can have no blockchain, and you can just ride on top of IntelliJ. You can do the same project that would have taken you 2 years and you can do it in a week.
This actually, I mean, I actually used to work, I still do to a certain extent, doing writing work for a lot of tech companies, and one of the ones I worked for in the past was a decentralized database company. And blockchain community is very bad at knowing its history. And it's like, decentralization is not new. Anyway, that actually sounds really fascinating, and probably something that would certainly appeal to the sorts of people I write for, actually.
It's the kind of thing where, like, you can apply it to.
And it is literally just Docker on top of something else.
And I think there are blockchain projects trying to do that, hosting with blockchain. But, what we're trying to say is how much easier it becomes when you don't have to develop your own blockchain.
Yeah, for sure.
Right. Huh. And so, I see that parallel to the internet where, before the internet, you would have had to first build a network and hook people up to your
network. And Docker provides all the networking and the virtual machine stuff as well. You don't have to worry about, like,
Exactly. So you just take these two technologies.
The Ethereum virtual machine or something, because it does virtual machines in a fairly production tested way.
Yeah. It's actually funny because here's something interesting. So when we announced Codeus, I actually looked at when did Docker come out. And the first release of Docker was 2013, which was at a time when me and a lot of other people were already working on smart contracts.
Yeah.
But think about how ubiquitous Docker has become. And how smart contracts are still kind of experiments.
You know?
I think it's like, it's very interesting how, and I think what's been missing with the blockchain technology for it to really take off in practice, not just speculative, but in practice, is this sort of pragmatic approach, the interoperability.
Exactly. They like to reinvent everything for some reason, which I find it frustrating, actually.
Well, I think it's to do with the tokens, right? You kind of have to reinvent everything to have a reason for your token.
Maybe. It's even just governance structures. Like, I remember sitting in one blockchain and like, we need a way to collaborate and... it's just like, if you just looked at the Git or, you know, these things have existed for a long time. Like, I don't know why. Or look at Open Source Software Foundations. They've been doing decentralized decision making for a long time. Like, learn from their mistakes and how they solve them. I'm like, I don't know. Sometimes I find it frustrating.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's a whole other topic.
Okay, so my name is Dennis Averin, and I'm peer consultant for the Multi-Blockchain Summit. And as you might know, the Multi-Blockchain Summit is organized in Malta, which has gained a reputation as the blockchain island. It's the first regulated blockchain jurisdiction in the world, I think. As far as I know, there is no one who has passed laws similar to those passed here in Malta yet.
As far as I know, I was actually at a recent conference, and there was a session where they talked about regulation, and I think Switzerland is getting close. But I don't think it's there quite yet. Singapore also may be close, but...
Crypto Valley is also a strong brand in this case.
Yeah, it's nice to have... places that aren't America ahead of things for once.
definitely.
So let's talk a little bit more about the conference, the event first. You have a lot of speakers from business and kind of regulatory side of blockchain and crypto than the technical side. Investors, advisors, legal people, et cetera, et cetera. So what are you aiming to achieve and accomplish with the summit?
Yes, so the summit, it's taking part in 1st and 2nd of November this year.
Mm-hmm.
And we're expecting actually as much as 5,000 delegates to come to Malta. And we have four conferences. So each conference has a theme. And it's first one is the regulatory. Then we have the affiliate marketing. And then we have the tech conference or developers conference, as you might call it as well, and also the cryptocurrencies conference. So the speakers we have invited are sourced for each conference due to the knowledge and experience that they possess. So, for instance, we have W. Scott Sternetta, who will be at the tech conference, and he's actually credited as the co-inventor of blockchain technology. Wall Street Journal ran an article on that. Stuart Haber, that's his colleague, because they wrote a research paper in 1991. And this research paper was referenced in the white paper for that was issued when Bitcoin was created. So Bitcoin was basically made out of their research.
That's actually interesting. One of the things I think the blockchain community is very guilty of is not knowing its history very well. And to actually have someone who, in theory, has been in it for a long time
is quite interesting. For sure. We're putting him in the limelight. And then we have some very, very large investors coming from Silicon Valley. And, for instance, Yida Gao, he used to be part of the largest venture capital fund in the world, actually. And now he's a general partner at Divergence Digital First Fund. It's a multi-strategy crypto fund. And he's coming all the way from Los Angeles and San Francisco, where he's usually based.
Yeah.
We also have Tush Ergul. She's Forbes 30 under 30.
Okay.
Also from the investment community. And we have people like Sonny Dillon.
Yeah.
His partner at Signia Venture Partners.
And I noticed this with the ticketing as well, the approach to having the separate events. Do you hope that people from different sides will meet and interact with each other? Because that's sometimes needed, I think. I think in this industry especially, everyone has slightly unrealistic expectations of what each other can accomplish. And maybe if they met each other and talked with each other a bit more, they would understand each other's perspectives better. So you're hoping to get people to mix with each other and understand each other's sort of side of the blockchain pie, as it were?
Yes. I mean, our motto is usually that business is done between people and not primarily between companies. So the way we built this summit, we tried to include everything, every sector that's possible to include in these different themes. And we will also have a two-day hackathon, an ICO pitch. And the expo floor will be filled with people all the time. It will be very, very buzzing expo floor, actually. It's not the kind of conference you go to where everyone just run in and out of the conference hall. The expo floor is filled all throughout the day. we definitely want people to find synergies. And we've also invited affiliates and blockchain developers for free, because that's really something that most of these companies are trying to find. Affiliates are difficult to find, because generally they don't operate like that. They go to conferences and you find them there. And they are very useful, since Facebook and Google are cracking down on everything crypto related. They have changed their stance just recently, but still, I don't think it's possible to push anything through Facebook yet, as far as I know. They don't allow all kinds of crypto advertising, for instance.
No.
So these affiliates are invited for free, and also blockchain developers.
Okay.
So we want people to be able to find the synergies they need in order to grow their businesses, and that's what we're aiming for with all these different conferences and venues.
I'm guessing from your accent, you're Scandinavian, Baltic-ish?
Yeah, that's correct, yeah.
So the reason I asked that is just what takes other people to Malta to get involved in the technology space?
It's a very good question, actually. Malta, it's like the Silicon Valley of Europe. So for me, it was a very pragmatic choice. I took my master degree in Italy at the University of Bologna. And after that, I was pretty much accustomed to the Mediterranean region.
Yeah.
But I wanted to go somewhere where it was a little bit, the business climate would be better, and somewhere where you could actually achieve something great. And I was looking around. I created a spreadsheet, and ticked all the pros and cons. And the decision was either Malta, Singapore, or Tel Aviv, in my case. And since Malta is within the European Union, the decision fell on Malta, for sure. Singapore is not in the Mediterranean region anyway.
No. Actually, let's dig further into Malta in a second. I just find that interesting, because I've sort of been going through a similar period myself. I somewhat miss the English-speaking world. Berlin is... you can get a long way, but you need some good German at some point. And I also lived in Australia for a long time, so I miss the warmer weather. We've been doing the same thing, building up a spreadsheet. And at least two of the places you mentioned are potentially on our spreadsheet. The European Union thing is an advantage. Unfortunately, I'm here in my British passport, so that's going to become less useful. So, it's another reason to look forward to coming to kind of explore some of that side of things. But the one thing that jumps out for me as being a potential negative, and then we'll get specifically into the blockchain aspect, is the size. Does the population, I just looked, just under about 500,000. Does the size of the country make it harder to, is it one of those very traditional small countries like Israel and some of the Baltic countries where they have to be very global because we can't service the servicing the local market isn't enough?
Yeah, most definitely. And I think it's been like that historically as well. Because there is not a lot of natural resources in Malta. They've always had to rely on their skills and expertise, mostly in ship repair and these kind of industries. Malta has always had to do something rather particular to be able to rise up and be a player on the global markets.
And is the, where do you think the kind of enthusiasm for blockchain comes from? Has there always been a general enthusiasm for technology over the past few years, or did it escalate around the blockchain? And what do you think attracted the government and businesses there to it so much?
Well, Malta is very future oriented, very pragmatic politicians here, and I mean they also have very good lawyers here, legal experts who would be able to figure out how to solve this quite easily. Because first you had the maritime sector, some of the best maritime lawyers in the world are based here in Malta. It's a very big nation in terms of ships that carries the Maltese flag. Then you have the iGaming sector. And there Malta was the first country in the European Union to regulate iGaming.
Okay.
And a whole infrastructure has been created around the iGaming sector. Mm-hmm. And it's quite large. I think it accounts for about 2% of the entire industry in the world is located here. And if you, you know, compare relative to the size, it's quite a lot.
You mean online gaming or?
Exactly. And then the leap from online gaming into AI and blockchain, it's not very far off. It's the skills to cater for that is already in the iGaming infrastructure, I would say.
And actually, even looking back further than that, an interesting thing with when you mentioned the shipping industry is the concept of kind of universally agreed, universal agreements around the world existed in the shipping industry for a very long time and still does, things like insurance and legal requirements and stuff like that. It's actually something a lot of people are not aware of. You know, some of these aspects have existed for quite a while. So I guess there's a history there with the legal profession being used to coming to agreement with other entities around the world.
Exactly. And then a second factor, I think, is any small country has a quite fast-paced legislature.
Yeah, for sure. So
there's not as many instances that a decision has to pass through before it becomes law. And some of these large countries like Germany or whatever, they point finger and say, "Oh, you opportunistic bastards, you're just, you know." But it's not that. They're not opportunistic. They're just bigger. And it goes for any small country. It's easier to pass a law in a small country.
Countries are just jealous, I think.
they are. I mean, in Sweden, for instance, they are launching their gaming regulations now, and they've been working on them for 10 years. For 10 years, they've been drafting. It's been sent back and forth within the government, different departments and so on. And all these opinions had to be circulated before anything could be passed into a law. But here everything is much quicker, and the same thing for Liechtenstein in Switzerland.
And also Singapore, the Baltic countries, especially Estonia, all these places, Israel. Well, maybe Israel. I visited Israel to interview startups last year, and I didn't get too much into that side of things. But I guess I'm not sure. They have some other issues that sometimes maybe slow things down a bit that so many other countries don't. And what's been what's kind of been recent news in the Malta blockchain space that might interest people to know?
Well, the largest cryptocurrency exchange is moving here. I guess you already know that, Binance. Okay. And then we have OKX as well. Okay. But then some couple of weeks ago, it was also announced that Binance is investing into the first distributed bank, Founders Bank. And that bank is going to be located here as well. And as far as I know, it's the first distributed bank in the world to be established. So each customer who will take part in that bank will also own part of the bank. So it will be distributed on a blockchain ledger, pretty much.
And when you say the exchanges are locating, are they actually physically locating or kind of legally locating?
I would say legally relocating. Okay. Because as Binance is also hiring a lot of staff in Uganda and different places. So, yeah, these are global corporations. So they will have offices in many different places. And so far, I don't know really how large the staff will be here in Malta, but some sort of HQ operations will definitely be located here, I think.
And I guess, ignoring the obvious ones like tax and stuff, what do you feel the other advantages to Malta are for these companies to locate there?
Well, weather is certainly one. When you work in a...
Advantages to Malta and to the Maltese people.
To the Maltese people?
Mm.
Of having the companies coming inside.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's boosted the economy, of course.
Yeah, okay.
and it creates new jobs, and Malta is placed on the map. This is like a historical thing, actually, that Malta is the first regulated crypto jurisdiction, so everyone is quite proud of that.
Well, I mean,
and the country is going through quite quick developments right now, so...
Yeah. So that was kind of my question. Like, does the technology space benefit kind of most people in the country?
Well, you know, development is in Malta is like in any other country. It's always a process which could be a bit rough.
Yeah.
Since you have to rebuild things, and some people aren't really ready to make the transition, but so far what I've seen it's handled very well, and there is not a lot of opposition to anything taking place here.
Okay.
Both of the political parties are quite aligned on the same goals. So.
Yeah.
I would say people are benefiting.
And is this the first time you're running the summit?
Yes, but the same company, we are running also the Sigma. That's the summit of iGaming Malta.
Okay.
And that was started 4 years ago by Eman Pulis.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's grown to one of the largest iGaming summits in the world, actually. So it's 12,000 confirmed delegates this year.
Okay.
But that's a different show. So it's,
For sure, it's I think that was going to be one of my questions, actually. Maybe you've just confirmed it's okay with 12,000 attendees. Can I'm not actually sure the city it takes place in, but let me see.
The show has outgrown every hotel.
Yeah, okay, that was going to be my question. Yeah,
we have to build a tent on a large open area, and then pretty much every hotel is
booked. Yeah. I guess I should book mine soon as well. being a freelance journalist, no one covers your expenses, so you got to get in early, I guess. And I think I remember we were in Lithuania, and we were speaking to the organizers of a gaming conference there, and they have a similar problem in that it's become so big that the local industry can't necessarily cope with the amount of people it's bringing, which is again good and bad, of course, for everybody.
Malta in general is a very good place to have events, because when you land at the airport, you have maximum between 20 and 40 minutes to your hotel. So it's not like when you go to a larger European city, it might be an hour or one and a half before you actually get to the venue.
For sure.
Here it's very, very short journey.
Yeah. And I guess just finally, is there anything that you would like people to know that we haven't covered about the event or about Malta in general?
Yes, I mean, the event as such, we've received so much enthusiasm, far above our expectations. When we compare it to when Sigma was started, it's doing much better than the first edition of that, in terms of tickets sold, exhibitors and everything. We're already pretty much sold out on all of our exhibition packages.
Okay.
And tickets, I think definitely we'll reach the target of 5,000 delegates. That's for sure. And the show is what we usually do is we put all of our exhibitors, sponsors, and whoever wants to attend into the limelight. So we make sure to organize a lot of events around the actual summit as well. So we have dinners. We organized an eye gathering in a pool party actually on the 16th of June together with Crypto Friends.
Yeah.
Crypto Friends is an event partner of ours.
Yeah.
And that was very well received. Many of our confirmed delegates for the summit, they came there and started to acquaint themselves already in June. So we have a lot of really good relationships forming around this summit, and that's amazing, actually.
Yeah, that's especially nice. I think one aspect of conferences I've especially found in Europe, even Southern Europe, in contrast to American conferences, is trying, like, especially if you work for a small company or on your own or something like that, trying to find people to hang out with in the evenings and things like that. It can be sometimes Europeans are not as gregarious as Americans, and it can sometimes be hard to find people to hang out with. So if you have lots of social events, it really helps to get people having a nice time. And then, you know, the evenings are when the real event happens, you know.
Exactly.
So, and also perfect for anyone needing early winter, but a winter break in from the Northern Hemisphere, or from Northern Europe and Northern America in early November. It's great. I've actually been to Web Summit in Lisbon around the same sort of time, and it's always a nice welcome quick respite from the weather. Also perfect for that too. Excellent. So on those limited tickets still available, what's the best place to find them? How can people get the tickets?
Then you go to www.maltablockchainsummit.com, and then you press buy tickets, and there you can get them.
Cool. And
currently they are at the reduced price. So
And I think I also noticed, which is very appropriate, you can pay in a wide variety of ways, shall we say, which is the way it should be, really. For a crypto conference, actually, very few do that, which is somewhat surprising. So that's also good. And also including more traditional, in quote marks, non
traditional payments like PayPal and Skrill and things like that too, which is also cool. As an international employee, I get paid so much in PayPal. It's always nice to just be able to pay directly out of it instead of converting it to proper currency first and things like that. So it's always great when you can do that.
We have it. So because we have a lot of guests from India countries, there could sometimes be a problem with if you don't process PayPal. That's the preferred method.
And that was my interviews with Stefan Thomas and Emmanuel Pooley, talking about Ripple, about Stefan's new projects, and about the Malta Blockchain Summit. If you have enjoyed the show, you can find previous episodes at gregoriousmemo.com/podcast. You can support the show at gregoriousmemo.com/support, and you can find us on Facebook. Just search for Gregorious Memo. I've been Christian Schiller. You can find me on christianschiller.com or tweet me at Chris Chinch. Talk to you next time.